Top stories this hour. Iran urges the US to stop insisting on its failed policies and excessive demands and act realistically to make way for a deal on the reviving of the 2015 deal. The Russian president downplays the impact of Western sanctions on his country, saying it's impossible to cut off Russia from the rest of the world. And the European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, taking the bloc's total financial support for Kiev to 2.5 billion euros. Thank you for joining us. Our top story today, Iran's foreign minister has urged the US to stop insisting on its failed policies to pave the way for a deal on reviving the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell. The top Iranian diplomat said the US must give up its unconstructive behavior and stop resorting to sanctions and pressure as leverage. He also added that Washington must drop its excessive demands and doubts and adopt a realistic approach to clear the way for an agreement. Amir Abdollahian stressed that there is no doubt about Iran's resolve to reach a good, strong and durable agreement. For his part, Borrell held Iran's positive and serious stance in the JCPOA revival talks, commended the initiatives offered by Tehran to resolve outstanding issues. Borrell said months of diplomatic efforts must bear fruit, vowing to continue his endeavors to narrow down the differences between Iran and the US to make an agreement possible. Iran has made a blistering attack on US President Joe Biden over his latest rhetoric against the country's nuclear program.
Irony of our times. Just on the anniversary of the first US nuke test, and after visiting an outlaw regime that possesses clandestine nukes, Mr. Biden stresses that he would not allow Iran to build bombs. Sales pitch to charm the Israeli apartheid regime by bombs that Iran has never sought.
Iranian Foreign Minister spokesman Nasser Kanani was referring to Biden's remarks during his recent West Asia tour that included a visit to Israel. Biden said in a meeting with acting Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid in Tel Aviv that Washington would use force to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. He later repeated his anti-Iran stance in Saudi Arabia on the second leg of his regional tour. Iran has time and again rejected allegations that it is in pursuit of nuclear weapons. Iran has also vowed a firm response against any military action against the Islamic Republic. On Monday, the naval commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps warned of a painful lesson to any act of aggression against the country. Brigadier General Alireza Tangsiri also said that Iran will nip the plots of the country's enemies in the bud. Journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier with his take on the main agenda of the US president's recent trip to West Asia. Let's take a listen.
The world generally knows what the Americans are about. It's about the economic interests. It's about, as my colleague said, the interests of Israel primarily. And don't forget, there's also the challenge that they face on the surface, on the face of it. There is this so-called Eurasian axis, which is rising. So Russia, China, Iran being included within that is something that the Americans will argue that it compels them to actually have a stronger hand in West Asia. In reality, Saudi Arabia has actually been making noises, very positive noises for Russian support, and has also been very open to China. It could be argued, therefore, that Biden's mission, other than Israel, was also to secure and lock down Saudi Arabia. You know, Donald Trump talked about milking the cow, and milking Saudi Arabia is certainly something the Americans have been awfully good at over the decades, and they want to continue that until that oil runs out completely.
The Russian president has downplayed the impact of Western sanctions on his country, saying it is impossible to cut Russia off from the rest of the world. Vladimir Putin emphasized that sanctions imposed by the Western countries would not turn the clock back on Russia's development. He, however, acknowledged that the sanctions have posed a, quote, huge challenge to Russia. Putin vowed that his country would not give up in the face of Western sanctions and remain in a state of disarray. He said Russia must develop its own domestic technology and technology firms to counteract the ban imposed on its access to foreign high-tech products. Since Russia launched a war in Ukraine in late February, the Western countries have imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow. The bans have targeted individual banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the Russian oil and gas sector. The European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, taking the bloc's total financial support for Kiev to 2.5 billion euros. There is growing disquiet in the bloc regarding the impact sanctions against Russia are having on the EU's economy. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU foreign affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialize.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A top human rights lawyer has revealed details of a threat from the Israeli military over his work with the Palestinian NGO labelled as a terrorist organisation by the regime. Michael Sfard, who lives in the occupied territories, represents Al-Haq, one of the six Palestinian organizations hit with a terrorist designation by the regime in October. According to the lawyer, Israeli officials have threatened him with 7 years in prison simply for representing the Palestinian NGO. This after Israel has come under fire for baselessly labeling the Palestinian organizations as terrorists. Last week, 9 EU states rejected the regime's allegations against these organizations, saying they will continue to cooperate with them. They said there was no substantial information to support terrorist designations of those NGOs. The UN has also slammed Israel's claim, saying it has undermined their work as several funders have withheld their contributions. As Russia continues its advance in eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas, Johnny Miller has traveled to a city which has seen some of the fiercest fighting of the war so far.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it. Now, this may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike. Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Johnny Miller, Severodonetsk.
An amber warning for extreme heat issued in the UK, a country with a policy to rapidly reduce climate damaging greenhouse gas emissions. But as Saeed Pourreza reports, a combination of a cost of living crisis and the need to find a new prime minister is calling into question Britain's commitment to reaching net zero by 2050.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Shia Muslims are celebrating Eid al-Qadir. The festivity marks the appointment of Ali ibn Abi Talib as the next Muslim leader after Prophet Muhammad. From Tehran, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has this report.
Everyone is invited to this party that stretches for 10 kilometers in Tehran. As Shia Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Ghadir, Iranians have got together in this festival to share the happy mood with each other.
This beautiful celebration has drawn many Iranians to enjoy Eid al-Ghadir festivity together. I congratulate all my fellow Muslims on the Eid.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all Muslims. We Shia Muslims regard this festivity as a chance to renew our allegiance with Imam Ali, our first Imam.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the beginning of Shia Islam some 14 centuries ago, when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib the first Shia Imam as his successor and Muslims' next leader.
On Eid al-Ghadir, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is known as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule based in Iraq's city of Kufa.
Imam Ali represents justice, humanity, and chivalry. During his rule, he eliminated sexual and racial discrimination and promoted kindness.
Here, not only do Iranians celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, they get to teach their kids about who Imam Ali was.
I named my son after Imam Ali. It's not just about his name. I like him to act and behave like Imam Ali. That's why I brought him to this ceremony. Imam Ali is a role model for all of us.
In Shia Islam, there are 12 imams or religious leaders, all believed to have preserved the legacy of the Prophet. Mahdi is the last imam, who is believed to be the apocalyptic savior of the world and is currently living in occultation.
To Muslims, Eid al-Ghadir is a time when God perfected their religion by introducing Imam Ali as their next leader. That's why they celebrate it every year to honor Imam Ali as the father of Shia Islam, a symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, that's a wrap for the world news. Thanks for joining us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
زیارت غدیر In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. Salam alaikum. Here is the fourth and last part of the memorable ziyarat of Ghadir, or standard form of salutation to the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, which we have been presenting you for the past 3 days. Please stay tuned. My master, it was through you that the truth prevailed, while the people disregarded it, and you expounded the precepts of Islam after they had become obliterated and effaced. Thus you were a forerunner both in waging jihad for the affirmation of the revelation, and yours is the merit of waging jihad for the sake of realizing its meanings. Your enemies are the enemy of Allah, deniers of the Prophet of Allah, who summon to untruth, judge unjustly, usurp power, and invite their confederates to hellfire. And there was Ammar, who, as he fought, cried out between the ranks of the confronting armies, "Come on, let's set out for paradise." When he asked for water, he was given milk to drink, whereat he glorified God and said, "He, the Prophet of Allah, may Allah bless him and his family, had told me, 'Your last drink in the world will be that of curdled milk, and you will be slain by the rebellious party.'" Thereupon, Abu al-Adiya al-Fazari encountered him and slew him, and may Allah's curse and that of his angels and all his prophets be upon Abu al-Adiya, and on those who drew their swords against you, and on those against whom you, O Commander of the Faithful, drew your sword from among the polytheists and the hypocrites, until the day of retribution, as well as on those who view with approval what offended you and did not decry it, turning away their eyes without disapproving, or provided their support against you through deed or word, or denied you their help, or deserted their duty of waging jihad alongside you, or those who belittled your merits, contested your right, or regarded as your equals such persons over whom Allah had given you a greater right than they had over themselves. May Allah's blessings, His mercy, His bounties, and His greetings and salutations be upon you and the immaculate imams of your descent. Indeed, He is the all-praiseworthy and all-glorious. But what is more amazing and more atrocious after the denial of your right is the wrongful dispossession of the orchard of Fadak from Zahra, the truthful and the pure one, the noblest of the world's women, and the rejection of your testimony and that of your illustrious sons and the progeny of the Mustafa, may Allah's blessings be upon you, while Allah the Most High had elevated your rank over the entire Ummah and exalted your station, and He had made manifest your excellence and honored you above all the world's denizens, keeping away all impurity from you and purifying you with utmost purification. Allah the Almighty and Glorious has said, "Indeed, man has been created covetous. He is anxious when an ill befalls him, and grudging when good comes his way. All are such except the prayerful." Thus Allah the Most High made His Prophet an exception to that, as well as you, O Chief of the Legatees, and excluded all other people. So how misguided were those who wronged you with respect to your right and then, for the sake of deception, assigned you the share of the kinsmen while denying it to its rightful claimants. So when temporal authority came into your hands, you let the situation remain as it was before in regard to your rights and those of the Prophet's family, disregarding them for the sake of your reward with Allah. So your ordeal with respect to these two things was like the ordeal of the prophets, may peace be upon them, in their loneliness and absence of helpers. Your conduct in sleeping on the prophet's bed was like that of Ishmael, peace upon him, when you assented and obeyed, as he did, patiently and seeking God's pleasure, when Abraham said to him, "My son, I see in a dream that I am sacrificing you. See what you think." He said, "Father, do whatever you have been commanded. If Allah wishes, you will find me to be patient." And so were you when the Prophet, may Allah bless him and his family, bade you to sleep in his bed, and in this manner you shielded him from harm by risking your own life. You were quick to comply, having obediently prepared yourself mentally to be killed, whereupon Allah, the Most High, appreciated your obedience and expressed the gracefulness of your action in his words, "May his name be glorified." And among the people is he who sells his soul seeking the pleasure of Allah. Yet again, your ordeal during the Battle of Siffin, when the scriptures were raised on spears as a deceptive stratagem, whereupon doubts arose in the minds and the truth was set aside and conjecture was followed, similar to the ordeal of Aaron when he was appointed by Moses to lead his people, whereupon they forsook him while he kept calling them, saying, "O my people, you are only being tested by it. Indeed, your Lord is the All-Beneficent. So follow me and obey my command." They had said, "We will keep on clinging to it until Moses returns to us." Such was your case when the scriptures were raised on spear points and you were saying, "O my people, you are being misled and deceived by this means." But they disobeyed you and demanded the appointment of arbiters, whereat you declined their demand and deploring their conduct before Allah, and let them alone. So when the truth was revealed and their wrong stand was discredited, and they admitted their mistake and oversight of the goal. But then they fell into disagreement and blamed on you the folly of arbitration, which you had opposed and they had desired and which you had warned them against, while they considered it legitimate, and held you responsible for the sin that they had committed, although you were on the path of insight and guidance and they were in error and blindness. Yet they persisted in their hypocrisy and perversity until Allah made them taste the evil consequences of their conduct. Those who opposed you became wretched and perished, and God slew them with your sword. He revived through your proofs those who were felicitous and they were rightly guided. May Allah's blessings be upon you at every beginning and end of your days and during all your movements and pauses. No eulogizer can encompass your merits, and no detractor can obscure your excellences. You are the best of the creatures with regard to worship, the most dedicated in piety, and the most zealous in defending the faith. With your efforts you maintain the laws of Allah, and with your sword subdue the armies of the renegades. With your hands you extinguish the flames of war, and with your discourses removed the veils of doubt, separated the adulterating falsehoods from the pure truth without being deterred by the blame of any blamer in any matter pertaining to Allah. The commendations of Allah the Most High suffices you to do without the praise of any admirer and compliments of any praiser. And Allah the Most High has said, "Among the faithful are men who fulfill what they have pledged to Allah. Of them are some who have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait and they have not changed in the least." Having seen that you had to fight the perfidious, the perverse, and the renegades, and that the prophecy of the Prophet of Allah, may Allah bless him and his household, had come true in what he had told you, and being content that you had fulfilled your pledge to him, you would say, "Is it not the time yet for this beard of mine to be dyed in the blood of this head of mine? Or when will the most wretched man from among this people rise up?" you were convinced that you possessed manifest proof from your Lord and full insight of your own affair, and that you will meet Allah rejoicing in the bargain you had made with Him, and that is the great success. O Allah, let your anathema, accompanied with all your curses, be on those who slew your prophets and the legatees of your prophets, and make them enter the flames of your fire. Let your curse be on those who usurp the rights of your wali, refused to acknowledge his covenant, and opposed him after acknowledging and being certain of his authority on the day when you perfected the religion for them. O Allah, let your curse be on those who killed the commander of the faithful and those who wronged him and their followers and supporters. O Allah, bring down your terrible curse on those who wronged Hussein and those who slew him, as well as those who followed and helped his enemies, those who approved of his murder and those who forsook him. O Allah, let your curse be on the one first to wrong the family of Muhammad, blessings of God upon him, his progeny, those who denied them their rights. O Allah, single out for your curse until the day of resurrection the first one who wronged the family of Muhammad and usurped their rights, as well as those who followed his policies. O Allah, bless Muhammad, seal of the prophets, and Ali, chief of the legatees, and his immaculate progeny, and appoint me to be amongst their adherents, among those who obtain victory and security through their wilaya, and who will have no fear, nor will they ever grieve. Dear listeners, what you heard was the fourth and last part of our special program of the past 4 days, and a special ziyara of the blessed day of Qadir for the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and congratulations to all on the occasion of Eid al-Qadir, the day on which God Almighty perfected religion by ordering his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to declare Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, as his vicegerent while returning from his farewell Hajj pilgrimage. So let us contemplate upon an aphorism by the leader of the pious and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Failures are often the results of timidity and fears. Disappointments are the results of bashfulness. Hours of leisure pass away like summer clouds. Therefore, do not waste opportunity of doing good.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, among the mistakes of the parents. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In today's lesson, we'll talk about the mistakes of the parents, or the mistakes that the parents do upon their children that don't lead to good results. Mostly, it's expected of a parent to be more understanding in the way he or she is dealing with the child. Because the parent has lived more years than the child has. The parent is older than the child. He's lived more years in the world than the child has. So sometimes, as much as the parents are trying hard to make it good, they're trying hard to bring up the children in a good manner, you find out there are a few mistakes that this particular guide or parent is doing in his life that make it difficult for the child to grow to be a good child, to be a better child. Now, one of the mistakes that the parents do during their parenthood is that some of them deal with their children as if they are small kids, you know, by imposing their wills on them. This may cause unhappiness and discomfort in the young boy or the girl. So this particular young boy, this particular girl that is growing up, expects to be respected, being that he or she is coming out of the children's world into the world of the adults. You know, up till today, there are some parents who are fond of cautioning their children, even when they grow up. For example, to be careful of cars on the road when they want to cross the road or when they want to go out to their workplaces or other places. Such advices are good advices for children. But they are not good for the grown-up who knows how to take care of themselves, you know. You can advise the kid to do things according to the age that they are into. A child or a kid who is 20 years of age should not be told, should not be advised as the kid who is 2 years old. So as parents, it's expected from us to be advising our kids. But how are we supposed to be advising them? We should advise them according to their age. A two-year child should be advised as a 2 years kid. And a 20 years old should be advised as a 20 years old child and not the other ways, because it will lead to bad results.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is ParseToday.com.
You can email us at EnglishRadio@IRIB.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is A to Z. We are talking about the mistakes, or among the mistakes of the parents, or the mistakes that the parents do in their day-to-day livelihoods. So you see, a parent, as much as they're trying hard to make it good to their kids, they are usually making so many mistakes that lead to bad results. So, among the mistakes that parents do during their parenthood is to enforce on our children a certain work or profession that we like, of which in the end, you find out that the child doesn't like that particular profession. The child doesn't feel to be like a teacher, but you as a parent, you're forcing the child to be a teacher in their life. This is because a young boy or the young kid, the young girl who is growing up, is an independent personality. You might like seeing your child to be a teacher in life. It might make you feel good, feel happy to see that your child has attained a certain responsibility, a certain career in their life. It will make you happy, of course, but you realize that the kid or the young girl, the young boy who is growing up, doesn't feel like doing that particular career, doesn't feel to be that particular personality that you want them to be. He's an independent personality. He wants to be different. He wants to be what he feels, because he's growing up as a different human being than you are. So you cannot enforce a certain career, a certain job, a certain thing that you think is good, you cannot enforce it on your kid. This is a big mistake that could lead in the failure of life of that young boy when he or she grows up in life. We should be careful about this. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for listening. Fi amanillah. Bye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
During a routine X-ray examination of one of Van Gogh's paintings, art conservators at the National Galleries of Scotland have discovered a secret self-portrait.
When we saw the X-ray for the first time, of course, we were hugely excited, absolutely thrilled to bits. Such a major discovery of an alternative composition happens once, twice in a conservator's lifetime.
The self-portrait was found during an examination of an 1885 painting by Van Gogh as the museum was prepping for an upcoming exhibition on Impressionism. Hidden from view for over a century, the self-portrait is on the reverse side of the Dutch artist's painting called The Head of a Peasant Woman. It was found beneath cardboard and layers of glue. Van Gogh is known to have often reused his canvases, working on their reverse side as well.
When he took the painting to Paris, he didn't have very much money. He was scrabbling around and decided clearly to use the back of these series of paintings that he'd brought with him from the Netherlands to Paris to explore self-portraiture for the first time.
Experts at the museum believe the materials covering the self-portrait were applied in the early 20th century before the art went on display. Art historians say when Vincent van Gogh was low on money, he took to painting on both sides of his canvases, but over the years, some of his reverse side paintings were covered up and lost. The X-ray image will feature at the Royal Scottish Academy in Edinburgh starting in July.
Children in Qatar are helping a conservation program revive the population of a critically endangered species of turtles. The children help release the baby turtles after they hatch, which usually takes place during the dark hours of the evening. The hawksbill mothers are cared for, if needed, when they arrive at the beach to lay their eggs. When the little turtles emerge, the weaker ones are taken to facilities at the foundation. There they are cared for until they are strong enough to be returned to sea. Program managers say getting children involved helps raise awareness about the endangered species and how they can help prevent some of the challenges these turtles face.
As adults, we are kind of beyond hope. Our brain is no longer plastic. We can't really learn new things. But children have the power to really internalize all these things that they're learning, that they're seeing. They make these habits part of their life. They make decisions based on, is it good for the environment, alongside with economic value for money kind of decisions. And this is what we want to cultivate.
The children also get a chance to form bonds with the hawksbill turtles. Some of them have even named the one they are going to release. That's why life experts with the conservation program say only 1% of every 1,000 hatchlings make it to adulthood. Poaching, climate change, fishing nets and marine pollution have all contributed to the dwindling numbers of the species. The program was launched roughly a decade ago and has released 30,000 hatchlings into the sea in the last 5 years. Experts are optimistic about the success of the program.
The more scientists make progress in space exploration, the more they get persuaded to delve into the mysteries of the universe. Now, the release of stunning full-color images from deep in the cosmos has put astronomers on the edge of their seats. NASA has unveiled high-resolution pictures from its James Webb telescope, which is the largest space-based observatory ever launched. The images took 2 weeks to render from raw telescope data. The $9 billion infrared James Webb was launched on Christmas in 2021. It reached its destination in solar orbit nearly 1 million miles from Earth a month later. Then the telescope underwent months-long process to unfurl all of its components. James Webb is now finely tuned and fully focused. The telescope is expected to shed light on the life cycles on planets of planets and galaxies.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The International Fajr Fashion and Clothing Festival has drawn fashion designers from Iran and around the world. The designs displayed are trendy and at the same time they conform to the Islamic dress code. Yusuf Jalali has this report.
It's the Iranian fashion's biggest day. The 11th Fajr Fashion and Clothing Festival brought under one roof fashion designers from across Iran and some other Muslim nations to step up their designs.
I have participated here as a fashion designer. I am so happy to be a part of this event because it acts as a platform that links designers to producers and it helps like promote quality design in the market.
This festival is a major event in the Islamic world's fashion industry because it helps promote fashionable clothes that conform to Islamic guidelines.
A typical Iranian woman wears a button-up coat called manto and a scarf covering the head. Some others wear a piece of cloth called chador, which covers the body from head to toe. One of the challenges Iranian fashion designers have to deal with is to tailor their designs to Islamic dress code or hijab while keeping them trendy.
Clothes represent the identity of a nation. As a designer, my mission is to design clothes that best represent the dresser's nationality and their culture. At the same time, the aesthetic aspect of the garment needs to catch the attention. I think this is an ultimate artistry if accomplished.
Smuggling is another persisting problem in the Iranian clothing industry. Out of the $8 billion annual turnover of Iran's garment industry, a whopping $5 billion is supplied through smuggling, say activists here. Experts say one of the reasons smuggling has the lion's share in Iran's clothing market is that it's more cost-effective to import foreign clothes rather than produce them domestically.
We are making our best efforts to push down the production costs, including the associated taxes, in order to promote designs that reflect our Islamic and Iranian identities, opposed to Western designs that seek to dominate global markets.
With all the actors in Iran's fashion industry present in the Fajr Festival, the event is seen as a place to highlight and address the challenges, with the aim to provide the stage for Iranian fashion activists to shine in the domestic market.
It might seem contradictory when we would associate fashion with the Islamic dress code. What is the art of a fashion designer that sews traditions to style and designs clothes that are both stylish and hijab? Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Elephants are the largest living animals on Earth that, in many cultures, are associated with good luck, wisdom, and fertility. But their overpopulation has become a matter of concern in the southeastern African nation of Malawi.
We want to reduce the population of elephants. in this park, in Luanda National Park, because currently we have 600 plus elephants in this park. We would be comfortable, ecologically speaking, that is, to have 300 elephants in this park.
Officials say they will relocate 250 elephants from a national park in a southern town to another park by the end of July. They say the plan is part of a national conservation initiative to maintain healthy habitats in the country's national parks. Establishing viable elephant populations and ensuring the prosperity of local communities around the parks are said to be the other aspects. Residents say the elephants often stray into their gardens and damage their crops. Authorities had relocated some 300 elephants from the same town in 2019.
A zoo in Mexico City celebrates the birthday of two very special residents, bringing cheers and excitement to visitors. Chinese pandas Xin Xin and Xuan Xuan have turned 35 and 33, becoming the oldest pandas in human captivity. China gifted their ancestors to Mexico back in 1975 to boost the relationships between the two countries. Later on, and thanks to the hard work of caretaker teams, eight cubs were born from the parents. Zoo officials say for them, learning the A to Z of panda care was a long journey.
The pandas living in Chapultepec, Xuan Xuan and Jin Jin, turned 35 and 33 years old, respectively. When their parents arrived, we didn't know much about pandas, so vets and biologists had to follow recommendations from those who took care of giant pandas in the People's Republic of China. From then on, we evolved. We found new and better diets and daily care practices such as vaccine administration or parasite removal. Then they started to breed, which was quite a success since it was the first panda that was born and which survived named Toy.
The birthday celebration has coincided with the zoo's 99th foundation anniversary. A panda's normal lifespan is estimated at about 15 to 20 years for those out in nature and about 30 years for the ones in human care. But the good news is, despite their old age, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin are in perfectly good shape. A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month, and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time, or the goat, for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says that by promoting Simba's image, he is trying to introduce Pakistan as a major goat breeding nation.
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region, as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the gray green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyya is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
If the conflict in Yemen is to end, the U.S. must engage in enhanced diplomacy and cut off the flow of weapons and other military support to the Saudi coalition. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Farah Hassan, a Foreign Policy in Focus contributor, in an article published under the heading, End the War in Yemen. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The United Nations has called the Saudi Arabia-led U.S.-backed war in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yet, even that designation hardly captures the full extent of misery endured by its people over 7 years of violence and unrelenting war. It is also a crisis that the United States has not only enabled, but has been instrumental in fueling through military aid to the Saudi coalition. A bipartisan resolution now before Congress offers an opportunity to achieve a permanent ceasefire in Yemen and provide sorely needed oversight of unauthorized U.S. military involvement there. If the conflict in Yemen is to end, the U.S. must engage in enhanced diplomacy and cut off the flow of weapons and other military support to the Saudi coalition. Congress must also address the constitutional issues raised by U.S. involvement in Yemen. If passed, House Joint Resolution HJR 87, introduced on May 31st, would accomplish these goals by invoking the 1973 War Powers Resolution. The resolution, sponsored by Representative Peter DeFazio and over 100 members of Congress, has the support of organizations from across the political spectrum. Its introduction comes in the midst of a fragile, temporary truce between the Saudi-led forces and other groups. Specifically, the resolution would end U.S. intelligence sharing and logistical support for offensive Saudi-led coalition strikes, including the maintenance and repair of coalition aircraft engaged in bombings. It would also prohibit U.S. personnel from assisting Saudi-led coalition forces engaged in hostilities unless they have prior congressional authorization. Despite the absence of congressional approval, the U.S. regime has continuously backed the Saudi coalition against the people of Yemen since 2015 by providing nearly $60 billion of military support and weapons to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. President Biden's previous pledge to withdraw U.S. support from offensive operations in Yemen has so far proven empty. His administration still sells arms to Riyadh and provides critical